Just for reference, I have the background equations of motion on the board here. We'll probably use them at various points throughout the lecture. Yeah, so yesterday we were just trying to study the behavior of inflationary perturbations. So we looked at the behavior of metric and inflaton perturbations in an inflating universe. And we saw that basically, just to recap, we saw that the dynamics of perturbations on an inflating background, there are two sets that basically there's only one scalar degree of freedom which we parameterize using a variable zeta. In the co-moving gauge where we worked, where the inflaton perturbation vanishes, this variable zeta you can think of as the curvature of spatial slices that are co-moving with the inflaton. And we also saw that there was a tensor degrees of freedom, gamma ij. These are transverse traceless tensors, and these have 2 degrees of freedom corresponding to 2 polarizations of gravitons. And what we did yesterday is we worked out the equation of motion for zeta. So, let's see, I'm just going to put this down slightly. Yeah, so what we did is we introduced this variable, the Mukhanov variable nu, which is just related to zeta by this factor z, which is a function of the background space-time, and it's just given by a phi primed over the conformal Hubble parameter. So what we did is we worked out an equation of motion for nu, which was this Mukhanov equation. We got nu double prime so we got this Mukhanov equation yesterday, and this describes the behavior of scalar perturbations in inflation. So z is just related to this Mukhanov variable nu. Nu obeys this equation of motion here. The little subscripts here are just to remind us that nu is a function of the co-moving momentum q, and actually just the magnitude. It doesn't really care about the direction. That's why it just, so little q here is just the magnitude of the free momentum. So the physics of what's going on, this equation is just a simple harmonic oscillator with a time-dependent mass. So let's look at a mode of some fixed momentum q. So, you know, the wavelength of this mode, the co-moving wavelength of this mode goes as 1 over q. And during inflation, the co-moving horizon is shrinking. So at very early times, the co-moving horizon, this is h to the minus 1, is very large. So in fact, basically, the effects of space-time curvature are negligible, and at very early times, the mode feels like it's just living in Minkowski space. So it just oscillates up and down. But during inflation, the co-moving horizon shrinks, and eventually you end up in a situation where at late times, the size of the co-moving horizon, well, at really late times, the size of the co-moving horizon gets very, very small, and the size of the co-moving horizon becomes much, much less than the wavelength, the co-moving wavelength of the perturbation. And in that situation, we find that this variable zeta freezes out. It goes to a constant. So, you know, as far as this equation goes here, we just have this. You can think of this as a time-dependent mass term. And at very early times, basically, the space-time curvature is negligible. We just have this term here, and that's like a simple harmonic oscillator. That's the mode oscillating at very early times. And at very late times, this situation here, when modes are well outside the horizon, basically, this term here dominates. And you can then solve to find that nu grows as a power law, and we're going to find zeta goes to a constant. So what I'd like to do today is I'd like to show you how we can actually solve this equation using the slow roll approximation. So let's see. So I'm going to abbreviate slow roll as SR just because my handwriting is slower on the board. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to work out what this function of the background geometry is using the slow roll approximation, and we're going to see that this Mukhanov equation here, this is the equation that governs the behavior of perturbations. Okay, so we're going to find that using the slow roll approximation, this Mukhanov equation just becomes a Bessel function, a Bessel equation. EQN is equation, right? So it becomes a Bessel equation, and Bessel's equation you can solve exactly. So what we're going to do is you can write the solutions of Bessel's equation in terms of things called Hankel functions, which are just complex combinations of usual Bessel functions. So functions, equations, Just my shorthand. Good, yes. Yeah. So basically there's an exact solution. This is an exact solution to an approximate version of this Mukhanov-Mode equation. Okay, and then the goal is that we're then going to try and compute the scalar power spectrum using this solution. Compute this guy. Okay. So let me just start. So I just want to recap briefly slow roll. So you've seen the slow roll approximation before last term in Latham's lectures. So you know, Latham gave a whole lecture about what happens to the background geometry during the slow roll approximation. So I'm going to assume some familiarity, but I just want to recap. So what we do is we introduce these slow roll parameters. So the slow roll parameters I think Latham used in his lectures, I'm going to write like this. So there's a slow roll epsilon parameter and there's a slow roll eta parameter, which are just related to the potential of the inferton field like this. And this basically just tells you that the background geometry is very slowly evolving. It's approximately de Sitter, it's just it's slowly changing. I want to point out that in fact, actually there's lots of different definitions of slow roll parameters. So many different sources, different textbooks will use different definitions of the slow roll parameter. But basically it's very easy just to convert from one to another. So in fact, the slow roll parameters I'm going to use today are defined as following. So in proper time, slow roll parameters are often quoted in proper time. So I'm going to start off in proper time, then I'll just quickly convert to conformal time in a second. So we have a slow roll epsilon parameter like this. It's the change in proper time of the proper Hubble radius. So one over h, this is the proper Hubble radius. And this is telling you how fast the proper Hubble radius is changing. So if this epsilon is small, then the proper Hubble radius is changing only very slowly. And if you use the background equations, the motion on the board here, for proper time, you can just go here. You know, this is minus h dot over h squared. H dot is phi dot. And then you just get this one here. There's also slow roll eta, which is phi double dot over h phi dot. Okay. So remember, dots are derivatives with respect to proper time, primes are derivatives with respect to conformal time. So these two sets of slow roll parameters are actually, it's very simple to relate them just using the background equations of motion. You'll find that to first order in slow roll, which means, so when these parameters are small, when epsilon and eta are small, you find the relation is just these two guys are actually the same, and this guy is equal to epsilon v minus eta v. So if you want to translate, sure.
Should that be just phi dot or phi dot squared?
Phi dot squared, yeah.
It doesn't look like it from that equation.
Yeah, let's check it. So this guy here is equal to minus h dot over h squared, and h dot is phi dot squared over 2.
Then that equation is wrong.
Yes, there's a square missing here. Sorry. Thanks. Good. right, yeah, that's right. Good, yeah. So basically, there's different definitions of slow roll parameters here. These guys here, in a sense, you know, these slow roll parameters, the subscript here is to remind you these are derived from the potential. These are often called the Hubble flow slow roll parameters because, actually, there's a little exercise if you want. You can show that my slow roll parameter epsilon here I'll just write this out. Yeah, so actually, if you use the background equations of motion, you can show that these slow roll parameters here, the epsilon and eta, can also be rewritten in terms of the Hubble parameter. If you think of the Hubble parameter as a function of the field phi, the inferton, you can show that this definition here is the same as this one here. So if you like, you know, these are slow roll parameters based around the potential, and these are slow roll parameters based around using the Hubble parameter, you know, the geometry instead of the potential. But so for today's lecture, we're just going to work with these guys here. But I just wanted to flag up for you that there are different definitions. You know, Weinberg, for example, his book uses these guys here, many other lecture notes use these potentials, slow roll parameters here. While we're at,
it's a typo.
It should be the space room, I think. One man's time is another space. Good, so just one more comment here. So in these lectures here, for this lecture here, I'm just going to work in these units where I set the reduced Planck mass to 1. So the reduced Planck mass is 1 over 8 pi g. And I'm going to set this to 1 in this lecture. I'll set it back, I'll restore it at the next lecture. But if you want to put back in Planck mass, if you want to restore this in your equations, it's very easy. Basically, what you have to do is you have to remember, yeah, so you just have to remember the dimensions of everything. The dimensions, the mass dimension of a scalar field is 1. The Hubble parameter, because it's a, you know, a dot over a, its mass dimension is 1. So for example, you know, if you want to restore the units, the Planck mass in this guy here, remember slow roll parameters, all of them, they're dimensionless. So if you want to restore the units into, say, this guy here, you can see that this is mass dimension 4 on the top and it's mass dimension 2 on the bottom. So you need a, you would need a 1 over m Planck squared here. Because you, so phi has mass dimension 1, the derivative makes it mass dimension 2, it's squared, so it's mass dimension 4 on the top. On the bottom, this guy has mass dimension 2 because it's h squared, so you need another factor of mass squared here on the bottom in order to make this guy dimensionless. So it's always easy just to restore Planck mass at any moment in time. You just have to remember the canonical dimensions of everything. Okay, I'll just, I'll raise that because it's not crucial. Okay, good. So, figure out how that machine works. Right, so we've got these slow roll parameters. We've just introduced these two slow roll parameters. And right, okay, so the first one here, let's now convert to conformal time. So that definition of the slow roll parameters was given in proper times, just so you've seen the definition proper time. If we convert to conformal time now, epsilon is just phi prime squared over 2 curly h squared, so co-moving Hubble parameter, and this is equivalent to 1 plus 1 over the co-moving Hubble radius squared. Remember, the co-moving Hubble radius, curly h is a times the proper Hubble radius times h. Okay, so the other thing you can do is you can use the background equations of motion to show that epsilon prime is equal to 2 epsilon, epsilon plus eta curly h. So this just comes from using the background equations of motion. It's good to try and show this. This is a very useful equation that we're going to use quite a bit today. So basically, what this means is that during slow roll, where epsilon and eta are small, so the slow roll approximation is just that epsilon and eta, these parameters are very, very small. So for example, you can see that that means that epsilon is approximately constant during slow roll because its time derivative with respect to conformal time goes as epsilon squared and epsilon times eta. So these are second order. So if epsilon and eta are small, their square is doubly small, right? So basically, during slow roll, the slow roll approximation, we're going to work to first order in slow roll parameters. So we're going to drop things such as epsilon squared and epsilon times eta. So to first order in slow roll, the right-hand side of this equation is just 0. So epsilon prime is 0, so epsilon is constant to first order in slow roll. Similarly, you can show that eta is constant to first order in slow roll because the time derivative of eta is also second order in slow roll. So let's see, I'll just move that down. Yeah, so, okay, so to first order in slow roll parameters, during slow roll, epsilon eta are approximately constant as their time derivative is the second order. Second order means it's like epsilon squared, epsilon times eta, eta squared, right? So if you look at this equation here, you can now just integrate it up because this guy is approximately constant, and so now we can just integrate this equation up to find what the co-moving Hubble radius does during inflation. So if you just integrate this equation here, I'll just put it like that. So we find the co-moving Hubble radius is just, let's see, I'll write it like this. So there's no constant of integration here. So remember, so during inflation, remember the conformal time runs from minus infinity to zero. The easiest way to think of that, I'll just move over here. Let's move over to this board here. You know, during inflation, the scale factor grows approximately exponentially with time. So for example, you've probably seen this before, right? But the conformal time is just the integral of the proper time over the scale factor. If you plug this in here, you would get e to the minus ht over minus h, if I've done that right. So basically, you know, as the proper time t goes to infinity, you can see that tau goes to zero, because this factor on the top goes to zero. And then in the past, as t goes to minus infinity, this thing blows up, h is positive, so and there's a minus sign there. So basically, t goes to infinity corresponds to tau goes to zero from below, and t goes to minus infinity corresponds to tau goes to minus infinity. So basically, so during inflation, basically tau goes to minus infinity is like the far past and the far future is like tau goes to zero. So the point is there's no constant of integration here because as you go to the far future and tau goes to zero, the co-moving Hubble radius shrinks to zero, which is what we want. If we had a constant here, then the co-moving Hubble radius would shrink down to some size. So there's no constant of integration there. Okay, so we just worked out, used the background equations of motion, and we've integrated them up to find what the co-moving Hubble radius does as a function of conformal time. Okay, good. The next thing we want to do, so we want to work out what the mass, the effective mass is in this Mukhanov equation here. So we need to work out what that z double prime over z is. Yeah, so remember, z is just a function of the background parameters. It's like this. Now, if we use this equation here, we can rewrite z as just a times root 2 epsilon. I'm going to take the positive root, okay? So it's plus phi prime over h prime over h. Okay, so now it's a little exercise. So what you want to do is you want to compute z double prime over z. Yeah, this is the quantity appearing in the Mukhanov equation up there. Okay, so it's an exercise. I want you to show okay, so z double prime over z. So just use this here and use, you've got this equation here for epsilon prime. So if you just use that and this, you can show in a few lines that z double prime over z is given by this factor alpha squared minus a quarter over tau squared. And this factor alpha here is just 3/2 plus 2 epsilon plus eta. This result here is, so we're working to first order and slow rolls, so you just drop things like epsilon squared and epsilon times eta. Just keep things, so when you just take alpha squared here, just square this and expand it out to first order and slow roll. So just show this, it's only a few lines. Okay. All right, so what does... So the Mukhanov equation here describing the behavior of perturbations during inflation, we've shown that during slow roll, the co-moving Hubble radius just shrinks like this, and we've worked out this factor z double prime over z. So now we know the form of the Mukhanov equation in the slow roll approximation. So basically, okay, so just plugging this into the Mukhanov equation. So again, you can see, you know, this is behaving as we expect, right? At very early times, tau goes to minus infinity, so this factor here goes to zero, and we just get oscillating modes, a simple harmonic oscillator. You know, that's this modes behaving in Minkowski space at early times, they just oscillate. At late times, tau goes to zero, and this factor becomes bigger than this factor. So this is the superhorizon limit where modes go outside the horizon. And in this limit here, we're just going to get power law growth for nu, which is going to correspond to zeta going to a constant. So we're going to see this work So our goal now is just to solve this Mukhanov equation directly. And what I want to show you is that this is in fact just a Bessel equation in disguise. Bessel's equation is a well-known second-order ordinary differential equation here. We know there are exact solutions, which are these Bessel functions. So this guy here is just, the Mukhanov equation is just a Bessel equation in disguise. To see that, you just need to do a change of variables. So what you should do is try setting, it's useful to introduce a dimensionless time parameter. Well, yeah, it's useful to introduce a time parameter x, which is just q times tau. So x is actually a time parameter. I'm sorry, this is actually sort of quite common notation, so don't be confused by it. But basically, so I'm just going to set x is minus q tau, and I'm going to introduce y. I'm going to do this the other way around. I'm going to say set nu q of tau is going to be equal to root x times some new function y of x. So I'm just changing my variables, right? Instead of using tau, I'm going to use x. Instead of using nu here, I'm going to use y. When you do that, this guy becomes Bessel's equation. Leave it like that. So if we just make that variable substitution here, actually it's probably better to write it on this board, isn't it? So when you plug this in, you get Bessel's equation. What you find is that 0 is equal to x squared y prime. So this is derivative with respect to x now. Sorry, I'll write that more clearly. Y double prime and x y prime So all we've done is we just used the slow roll approximation to work out what the background geometry is. We've plugged that into the Mukhanov equation for nu, and we've shown it takes this form here. With a simple variable transform, you can show that it becomes Bessel's equation, and we know the solution to Bessel's equations, they're Bessel functions. But actually, I spoke too soon. In a sense, it's going to be more useful to use things called Hankel functions, which are just a linear combination of the usual Bessel functions. So we're going to write the solution, the general solution, as follows. Solution. I'll just write it first, and then we'll discuss it in a sec. Okay, so first of all, these Hankel functions here, the Hankel functions H, these are just linear combinations of the Bessel functions. So you might be familiar with the Bessel J and Bessel Y functions. So I don't know whether you come across Bessel's equations, Bessel functions before. There's a lot of good material out there on the web about it. For example, there's actually a really nice article on Wikipedia and stuff, or MathWorld. So there's plenty of discussion out there of Bessel functions, which are just solutions of Bessel's equations. They crop up everywhere in physics. You know, like if you have waves in your coffee mug, when you drop something in your coffee, you get these waves. So these are Bessel functions. They're circular Bessel functions. You know, one set of solutions of Bessel's equations, these Bessel functions J and Y, is actually useful to work with a complex linear combination of these Bessel functions J and Y, which are these Hankel functions here. So K Hankel. So Hankel function 1 and Hankel function 2, which is just a complex conjugation, so just change that to minus I. Okay, so the general solution we can write in terms of Hankel functions, the root x comes about just from here because nu is root x times y. And there are also constants of integration A1 Q and A2 Q. The Q subscript is just to remind you that we're solving this equation. In this equation, Q, the momentum, is a parameter. So the constants of integration here, these are really functions of Q. You know, when you solve this equation for each mode, each Q mode independently, you know, you could get different constants of integration. So these are really functions of Q, which I just put as a little subscript there. Is that? All we're doing is solving a second order differential equation here. So yeah, so we've just seen that the two solutions which I can write in this form here is a sum of two Hankel functions. Why this is useful is that Hankel functions oscillate at early times, whereas Bessel J and Bessel Y, one of them blows up and one of them goes to a constant. So it's useful to take, it's useful to work with this different combination Hankel functions because they have the right oscillatory behavior at early times. In fact, we're going to see at early times, this whole guy, the initial conditions are just going to set this guy to zero. Okay, so let's not get ahead of ourselves. Okay, so let's look at the limits of Hankel functions. Let's look at the limits of this solution here. Okay, so the first limit is the early time, the sub-horizon limit. I'm going to write this here. So limit one is where x goes to infinity. So I'll put it here. This is the sub-horizon limit. So remember, you know, the sub-horizon limit was this one at early times where the momentum q is much, much greater than the Hubble parameter h. And we've just seen that the Hubble parameter roughly goes as minus 1 over tau. So basically, you know, at very early times, this guy goes to zero, so q is much, much greater than h. And remember, x is minus q times tau. So x goes to plus infinity. Remember, you know, x is equal to minus q times tau. So at very early times, tau goes to minus infinity. So that means x goes to plus infinity. So the sub-horizon limit, when the modes are well inside the horizon, this is where this time parameter x goes to infinity. So let's see, what do Hankel functions do in this limit? So we're just going to look at the asymptotic behavior of these Hankel functions. So again, it's just one of these well-known properties of Hankel functions, but you find that as x goes to infinity, the Hankel function has this asymptotic form like this. So it goes as root 2 over pi x, and then there's just an exponential factor, which I'll write like this. So it just goes as e to the ix plus some phase, which we aren't really going to care about. And the other Hankel function is just a complex conjugate of this, so you just get a minus ix here instead. Okay, so this factor here, this is just some phase, and we're not really going to care about this. It's not really going to matter in the calculation we're going to do, and we'll see why shortly. But actually, you can see, yeah, so you can see that basically at early times, the mode goes inside the horizons, and they oscillate as e to the ix, which is e to the minus iq tau. Okay, so at early times, nu oscillates in the sub-horizon limit. Now, let's try and move that up. Ooh, sweet. Good. Okay, the other limit is going to be the super-horizon limit, late times, which is going to be x goes to zero. So super-horizon means the modes outside the horizon. So you can see that at late times, when tau goes to zero, x goes to zero. So this is the super-horizon or late times limit. Yeah, it's quite useful. Yeah, so this is basically early times for fixed momentum. And this is going to be sort of late times when modes are outside the horizon. This is, yeah, for fixed Q. Okay, so in the limit where x goes to zero, what does a Hankel function do? So the Hankel function just becomes a power law. It just grows, it just has power law growth. Let's see, I want to separate these two. Hopefully that's not too messy. Okay, so the limit where x goes to zero, the Hankel function behaves like this. So it goes as I over pi, then there's a gamma function of alpha, and then it goes as x over 2 to the power minus alpha. Gamma functions, have you seen gamma functions before? They crop up all the time in quantum field theory. It's basically like a generalization of the factorial function. You know, the definition is, these are my favorite functions. So like, well, yeah, so it's something like gamma of alpha. It's just the integral from 0 to infinity of, let's say, dt, t to the alpha minus 1, e to the minus t. So in fact, you know, it's quite fun. If you've never seen gamma functions before, it's terrific fun just to work out if alpha is an integer, then you can show that this is like a factorial. You can show that gamma n for integer n is just n minus 1 factorial. And you can just show that by integrating by parts all the way down. So give that, these are good fun. And so of course, gamma functions also work for non-integer values. So if you like, it's a generalization of the factorial function to non-integer values. But they crop up all the time in quantum field theory. Yeah, so the Hankel function at late times just becomes, you know, this constant factor out the front, and then it just has a power law. It just goes as x to the minus alpha. Remember, alpha was just this factor. Ooh, alpha was over there. So basically 3/2 plus some small stuff. So at late times, nu grows as a power law. Power law growth. But remember, zeta is going to go to a constant. We'll see this shortly, just in a sec. Okay, so let's set the initial conditions. Good, we're doing well for time. Okay, so I think I'm out of blackboards. I'll just set that back to default. Is that good? Everyone see everything? All right. They're totally Dr. Evil, these blackboards, aren't they? It's like, you know, the missile silo cover opens.
Don't press the wrong button.
Yeah, yeah, the poor. That's the red button you have on your desks. Okay, so right. We want to set, okay, so what we've been doing so far is we just solved a differential equation. Big deal, right? We had this Mirkonov equation. We worked out the background geometry during slow roll. It turned out it was a Bessel function, and we wrote the solution in terms of these Hankel functions. So we solved a second order differential equation. Now we've got to put in the initial conditions for this differential equation. So this is this Bunch-Davis vacuum. So let me just right. So if I understand correctly, you've seen this before in Latham's lectures from last term, the Bunch-Davis vacuum. So my plan here is just to sort of quickly write down what it is, and then after the lecture, if there's time, we can go over it again just to remind you how it all worked, or we can discuss it later in the tutorial this afternoon. But I just want to make sure I get through all the way to the power spectrum in this lecture. So, you know, I'm just going to quote what it is. So the idea of the Bunch-Davis vacuum, remember, at very early times, modes are far inside the horizon, and so they're oscillating. They just feel like they're living in Minkowski space. At very early times, because the size of the horizon is so much bigger than the co-moving wavelength of the perturbation, the effect of space-time curvature is negligible. It's just like a mode living in Minkowski space. So the idea of the Bunch-Davis vacuum is that, you know, the vacuum you choose for your quantum field. So remember when you quantize fields, you know, you split them up into creation operators and annihilation operators, and there are these mode functions that appear in the solution. And, you know, if you make different choices for the mode function, if you choose different solutions for these mode equations, you get different choices of vacuum. And the idea of the Bunch-Davis vacuum is just that you want to choose the solution so that it looks like the Minkowski vacuum for a co-moving observer. So an observer who sits at fixed x coordinates and his time coordinate is just tau, his time evolution operator is id by d tau, and you just want to choose this co-moving observer in Minkowski space. This co-moving observer, he wants to see the Minkowski vacuum. Yeah, so I can come back and give a more systematic derivation later if you like. But the net effect is it just sets the initial conditions for the mode function nu. Yeah, so we can discuss this later. This is also discussed in one of Latham's lectures. The basic idea is we're just setting the initial conditions. So basically the choice of vacuum condition, the Bunch-Davis vacuum, that sets the initial conditions for nu at early times. And basically this just says this is just the Minkowski vacuum for a co-moving observer. And the fact you've got a minus IQ tau here rather than a plus IQ tau, that's really what's important. Okay, so minus IQ tau is plus IX. So you can see, you know, the Hankel function. So at early times, so we've got these two Hankel functions here. At early times, the Hankel functions, H1 goes as e to the plus IX, H2 goes as e to the minus IX, because it's a complex conjugate. But you can see at early times, we want modes to go, we want nu to go, we want at early times, we want nu to go as e to the plus IX. So basically, that corresponds to keeping only H1 and setting H2 to zero. So the Bunch-Davis vacuum. So the point is this. So we select the first Hankel function. So we set the second one to zero. So we set AQ2 to zero, and AQ1 just becomes this guy here, half. These AQs, so remember, we just got this general solution here. We want it to oscillate as e to the plus ix, so we set this guy to zero, and this constant of integration here, we set to this one here. So those are the initial conditions. One point that I'm going to mention, in a sense, we're not going to care. So we're going to see basically that the power spectrum depends on the mod squared of nu. We're going to see later that basically the power spectrum is going to be related to the mod squared of nu. So basically the phase of nu, we're not going to care about. It's unobservable. It's not going to appear in the power spectrum. So for that reason, I actually, in a sense, I don't really care what the phase of this guy is here. You could add in an arbitrary factor of e to the I times some phase, if you like. It wouldn't change the calculation because we just care about mod squared of nu. But so I'm just going to write this as the modulus of AQ is this guy here. That's all I'm going to care about. You know, so in a sense, this phase factor here, it isn't going to matter because it's not going to appear when you take the mod squared. No, it's not, because this factor here, you see. So that's right here. So basically H1... No, but this, it's a sign I care about, you see. So H1 goes as... So plus some phase, and this goes as minus IX plus some phase. So I agreed the phases we don't care about, but we care about the fact that this is a minus IX and that's a plus IX. No, you see, so the mod squared is going to be at late time. So in a sense, we'll come back to discuss this in just a second. The idea is at very early times, yes, so we have two solutions, one going as plus IX and the other is going minus IX. And basically, this one here corresponds to the positive energy, the positive frequency mode as seen by a co-moving observer. So this is like the positive frequency mode. So remember in, so for a co-moving observer, basically his time evolution operator is is I d by d tau. And so if you hit this guy here with this time evolution operator here, you get plus q over, I think it's q over a. No, there's no a, is there? I often think in proper time in my head. Yeah, so basically this guy here, you get plus q here, whereas if you chose the other mode, h2, this will be a plus IQ, and that will correspond, that will give you a minus sign here. So that will be the negative frequency mode seen by a co-moving observer. So when you quantize, so the idea of the Bunch-Davis vacuum is that the mode we're picking is the one that corresponds to the positive frequency mode seen by a co-moving observer, which fixes that sign to be minus IQ. Because this is like Schrodinger's equation, right? You know, I d by d tau is h psi, and you want h, the energy, to be positive. So the idea is a Bunch-Davis vacuum, it cares about the sign we see here, because you know this minus sign means that it's a positive frequency mode, and that selects this guy here and kills this one here. H2 corresponds to like the negative frequency mode seen by a co-moving observer. So and then what we do is so that sets the initial conditions, then we evolve out to very late times, and then we take the mod squared at very late times. Yeah, so in a sense, what phase I choose here, so it's important that I've chosen H1, but the phase I've chosen here at early times, you know, when I evolve out to late times, it isn't going to contribute. So I can, so in a sense, I don't really care about that phase there. You can put it in if you like, it'll just drop out of your calculation. Good. Yes, let's look at what happens at late times. Can I erase? No, okay, thanks. I always feel uncomfortable about using these blackboards here in the corner. Is this still visible? Yeah, okay. Okay, so we looked at what happens at early times. We looked at the Bunch-Davis vacuum. That set our initial conditions. We've killed this second Hankel function. We've just kept the first Hankel function, which behaves as the positive frequency mode. Now we evolve out to late times. So, you know, we use this guy here. So we work out what happens to Hankel functions at late times. They just go as power law. So let's see what happens at late times. So in this far blackboard here, okay, so just plug it in at late. So at late times, we find that the mod of nu q goes as 2 to the alpha minus 1. My favorite gamma function. X to the half minus alpha. Okay, so I just used this guy here, the general solution, and I set the constants like this. So you find that at late times, nu just grows as a power law like this. Remember, we're not really going to care, because we're going to take the mod squared at late times, I don't care about the overall phase. So for that reason, I'm just going to put a mod sign here. You know, you can insert a phase, but it isn't going to change anything. Good. Okay, but what we really want to do is we want to compute the power spectrum for zeta, the co-moving curvature perturbation. Remember, zeta was related by that factor of z all the way there in the very far top left. You remember, nu is related by a factor of z to zeta. I'll just restore these. You know, this is just reminding you that both nu and zeta, these are describing perturbations. They're functions of the magnitude of the momentum q here. That's just what this subscript q is to remind you of. So if I want to work out what happens to zeta at late times, what does zeta do? So, okay, so nu grows as x to the power half minus alpha. What does zeta do? So I need to work out what this factor of z does in order to work out. So I know this guy, I want to work out that guy, and then I can work out what zeta does. Okay, so what I need to do is I need to know what is z as a function of t. Let's put it here. Okay, so we worked out what nu does, and now I want to find out what zeta does at late times to compute the power spectrum of zeta, so I need to know what z of tau does at late times, which we haven't actually worked out so far. So what we did earlier is we worked out this differential equation here. We worked out z double prime over z. We can do a similar job here. So another little exercise. So you can also work out just z prime over z. It turns out to be a half minus alpha over tau. So remember how this worked? Remember z was just a times root 2 epsilon, and we had this equation that said epsilon prime is 2 epsilon plus eta h. So if you just use those two together, you can show that z prime over z goes as 1 over tau. If you integrate this up here, you find that z is proportional to tau to the half minus alpha. And you know, tau is just proportional to x for fixed q. Okay, so you can show that this factor of the background geometry, z, just goes as x to the half minus alpha. But nu also goes as x to the half minus alpha. So you can see that zeta is going to a constant. Zeta q goes to constant. Yeah, this is this freeze out people often talk about. I'll just raise that board now. Okay, so let's not lose track of the bigger picture, right? We're just trying to understand the behavior of the scalar perturbation mode, zeta in inflating universe. And we've seen the equation of motion was this Mukhanov equation. We've seen that it basically just reduces to a Bessel function, a Bessel equation, the solution of Bessel equation of these Hankel functions. And we've seen that Bunch-Davis vacuum corresponds to just keeping one of the Hankel functions and throwing away the other one. And so we set the initial conditions, we've evolved out to late times, and we've seen what the behavior of nu is at late times. And we've worked out the behavior of this factor z, but only up to a constant of proportionality. Okay, so I know that zeta goes to a constant because z goes as x to the same power as nu does, but I want to know what this constant actually is. If I'm going to work out the power spectrum, again, this is something you've probably seen before in Latham's lectures. We're going to use this later. I can, if I have time at the end of the lecture, which I might do, then I'll remind you where this comes from. But basically, remember the power spectrum for zeta is going to turn out to be q cubed over 2 pi squared times the mod squared of zeta at late times. So actually, to work out the scalar power spectrum, I really want to know exactly what the value of zeta is. It's no good just saying it goes to a constant. I want to know exactly what that constant is. So I need to fix the constant proportionality in this equation here. So this is the interesting part of the calculation. This part is that, you know, in a sense, everything we've done so far is basically straightforward manipulation of an equation of motion. The slightly interesting part of the calculation is just working out this constant proportionality. Okay, so let's pick some reference time. Yeah, so we want to compute the constant proportionality. Well, I want to know exactly what z does as a function of time. So what I do is I pick some reference time. Which I'm going to call tau star. And then I can just write z as being z evaluated at tau star times tau over tau star to the power half minus alpha. So I've just, you know, all I've done is I've just told you that at some reference time tau star, z takes the value z star. You know, so I'm just, so now the question is, what is z star? Okay, so let's choose this reference time to be the moment of horizon crossing. Let's write it this way. So this is when the mode crosses the horizon. In other words, when Q is equal to h. So h star, so in other words, is equal to h at the time of. So I'm looking at some given mode of momentum q, and I'm going to choose some time tau star, so that's that h evaluated that time tau star is equal to q. This is when the mode crosses the horizon. Subscript stars and everything are just going to be mean evaluate this quantity at the time tau star when the mode crosses the horizon. Okay. Now, we worked out somewhere near the beginning of the lecture here, we had this equation for what the Hubble radius does as a function of tau. So I can just plug that in here. So if I've got all my factors correctly, this should be equal to 1 over tau star, 1 plus epsilon star. So remember, we're working to first order and slow roll. So you need to invert that equation there, and then that epsilon minus 1 will be on the bottom, and then you just, it's a Taylor series, you just expand it out, and that's how it comes up, plus epsilon on the top here. So we're always working to first order and slow roll, so you can just expand things out and drop epsilon squared terms. Okay, so we're nearly there. Bear with me. Okay, so x star, which is minus q tau star, that's just 1 plus epsilon star. Okay, so what's this guy here? So I can also write z as being z star, x over x star. Let me just be pedantic, and then we'll all this equation is saying is z is proportional to x, right? And then I've just said that the value of z at x equals x star is equal to z star. But x star is basically 1 plus a small parameter epsilon. So when you plug that value of x star into here, we can really forget about this epsilon. This will be a sub-leading factor when you plug it into this equation. So to first order, this is just z star x to the half minus alpha. So you can plug that into there. If you expand it out to first order, you just get z star x to the half minus alpha. Shout out if my board writing isn't clear. Okay, but I still need to tell you what z star is, all right? Because remember, so z star is just alpha star to epsilon star. So remember, z is alpha root 2 epsilon. Star just means evaluate at the moment of horizon crossing when tau is equal to tau star. Okay? So horizon crossing, remember, so if q is equal to h star, remember the co-moving Hubble radius, you can rewrite in terms of the proper Hubble radius as a h star. So that a star, I can also write as q over h star. So I can just rewrite that as q, let's write it like this, shall we? No, I won't bother about that. 2 epsilon star over h star. Okay? So now actually we're done, we're home and dry. So at late times, so all I've done is I've just fixed the constant of proportionality. So I want to know what this factor of z is. I know that it's proportional to x to the half minus alpha. I want to fix the constant of proportionality z star. I can write that constant of proportionality in terms of the proper Hubble parameter at horizon crossing and this slow roll parameter epsilon, also evaluated at horizon crossing. So I know now what zeta does at late times. Thus at late times. Okay, so that was just plugging in, you know, we know what nu does at late times. We know exactly what this factor z is in terms of z star, which is this guy here. If I just put it all together, then I find that at late times, you know, that's tau goes to zero. I find zeta goes to this factor here. And in fact, we can do just one more little trick. Remember alpha is just 3/2 plus some slow roll parameters, 2 epsilon plus eta. So in fact, we're just working to first order and slow roll here, okay? So when I plug this into the gamma function, this is approximately gamma of 3/2 plus some factors of order slow roll, which I'm not going to care about. So gamma of 3/2 is just root pi over 2. Just do that interval over there. And so the idea is that we're just going to care about leading order and slow roll, you see. So if I plug this into here, you can see that you'll get 2 to the power, you know, 2 epsilon plus eta, but that's basically 1 plus factors of order epsilon eta. So I'm just going to keep the 1, the leading term. So leading order in slow roll, if you evaluate this, you just get h star, becomes much, much, much simpler, just h star q to the 3/2 root epsilon evaluated at horizon crossing. Okay, so stars, remember, stars are always meaning evaluated at horizon crossing when q is equal to the co-moving Hubble radius, Hubble parameter. Yeah, so let's see. Yeah, so really, we're there now, folks. So we have little time, so I'm going to try and justify briefly at the end where this formula for the power spectrum comes from, but let's just plug this in for now. So the late time power spectrum or the super horizon power spectrum so it's just q cubed over 2 pi squared times zeta q squared And when you work this out, just plug that in. H star squared over 8 pi squared epsilon star. So this is the holy grail. So this is the slow roll scalar power spectrum at first order and slow roll. Yeah, scalar power spectrum. So it's just a proper Hubble parameter squared at horizon crossing over this factor of epsilon here. So remember, this is actually, although it doesn't look like it, this is actually a function of the momentum. Because these parameters here, h and epsilon, they're evaluated at the moment of horizon crossing. And the particular time corresponding to horizon crossing is different for different modes. Different modes have different q, and therefore they cross the horizon at different times. So in fact, h and epsilon are very slowly varying functions of q, because different q's correspond to different times. Okay, just for completeness, I've got just a minute or two. Perhaps let me just remind you. So you've seen the quantization of scalar fields before. We can discuss it more in tutorials later this afternoon. I just want to, since we've just used this formula here, perhaps it's a good idea just to justify where this formula here comes from, just to remind you. I think I can do this in just a minute or two. So remember, when we quantize, let me just do this briefly, we can discuss this more later, but when you quantize fields, so everything we've discussed so far has just been doing classical perturbations. We just solved the classical perturbed Einstein equations. The only points we've used quantum mechanics are to choose the Bunch-Davis initial conditions, that comes from quantum mechanics, and then this power spectrum here, you know, this formula here also comes from quantum field theory. So when you quantize fields, you promote the field to an operator like this. In momentum space, I can write it like this. I'm going to put it like that. Just want to make sure I get my factors right. There it is, right. Yeah, okay. Sorry, that's a hat. So when you quantize fields, right, you promote them to operators. You've got creation and annihilation operators here, and zeta appears here. This is what we call the mode function. And this, remember, the zeta is just the solution of the classical equation of motion that we've been working out. So when you compute the two-point function in the Bunch-Davis vacuum, I'm going to just, I'm just going to drop the tau dependence. I'm just going to write the q part here. So remember, these obey the usual creation and these obey the usual commutation relations. So if you just plug this definition here to compute the two-point function of two different momenta, q and q primed, what you find is you get zeta of q squared, and then you get a delta function that tells you the two momenta must be opposite. So the two-point function in momentum space. There's a delta function that tells you the two momentum must be opposite, and then there's just this factor of the mod squared of the mode function. And the definition of this guy here is just as follows. Let's just try and raise that briefly. Good. So remember, you look at the to define this power spectrum here, you look at the field variance in position space. So, So if you just look at zeta squared at some position, I'm going to drop the zeros. You know, I'm always meaning the vacuum state here. If you just look at the field variance, so that zeta squared at some fixed position, and you can. This is just going to take, I'm just going to write about 5 lines. It won't take long. So what I'm doing now is I just want to remind you where this definition comes from, you know, what we mean by this power spectrum here. You've probably seen this before, but I just want to emphasize it because it's quite a useful calculation. okay, so we quantize the field, we work out the two-point function momentum space. Now I'd like to compute the field variance at some point in position space, because that's where the definition of the power spectrum is going to come from. So I can write the field variance in position space as the inverse Fourier transform of the two-point function momentum space. Because it's the same position here, you get e to the iqx at e to the iq prime dot x, so I can just collect them together like this. If I plug in, so I just worked out what this guy is here, right? If I just plug this into here, then you find that you get a delta function which kills this guy here. So what you get, let's write it, I think I can write it here. Okay, let's see if I can just raise this further. Okay, so this guy here, now if you just expand this out, right, you just get 1 over 2 pi cubed, then you get 4 pi q squared dq times zeta q squared. So remember, zeta, it's isotropic, right? Zeta doesn't care about the direction of q, so I can just write this as a spherical shell, 4 pi q squared dq. Now just expand this out, you can write this instead as the integral of log q, so that's dq over q, and then times q cubed over 2 pi squared. And this is the definition of the power spectrum, we'll be just done in a second. So that's how we get the power spectrum, right? The definition of this power spectrum here is it's the contribution to the field variance per logarithmic interval of wave numbers q, or interval of momenta here. H bar is 1, so a momentum and a wave number are the same thing. So the power spectrum is a contribution to the field variance per log interval of momenta. So that's where this formula here that we've used here comes from. Okay, so we're going to finish here. So what we did today is we just solved the Mukhanov equation to describe the behavior of perturbations in inflating universe, and we worked out the scalar power spectrum, and this is our result here. So we'll finish here. Thank you.
Brief comment. Paul just corrected my mistake. So who can tell me how all the dimensions in this formula works? You will also repeat this in your homework.
Oh, yes. Excellent.
What's that? Which formula? So for the power spectrum, right? So we have the two-point function of theta q, right? So I said that has dimensions of k to the 6. For some reason, I still don't understand. But that actually has dimensions of k to the minus 6, right? Because I integrate that over Fourier space q, and I get something dimensionless.
Yeah, exactly. So in position space, this guy is dimensionless, because zeta is just a metric perturbation. You know, just this guy just appears in the metric, so it's dimensionless. So this guy here is dimensionless. But when you Fourier transform, if I write this as an inverse Fourier transform, forget about the 2 pi factors, you get zeta of q primed, you know, e to the I, q, da-da-da-da-da. So the point is, this guy's dimensionless, but there's a factor of momentum to the power 6 where you do the inverse Fourier transform. So because this is dimensionless, and that's momentum to the power 6, the two-point function momentum space has dimensions momentum to the power minus 6. So this guy has dimensions q to the minus 6, but remember, so I need to bring this board down now. It's just dimension, it's just sort of ambulance chasing, but yeah, okay, so that guy there, which is this guy here, this has dimensions momentum to the minus 6, and this delta function here has dimensions minus momentum to the minus 3. The way to think about delta functions is that you can integrate a delta function 2 pi cubed, and you get 1, right? So if you integrate the delta function over momentum and you get 1, this guy's momentum cubed, so this guy must have dimensions momentum to the minus 3, so dimensions minus 3. This guy has dimensions minus 6. That guy's dimensions minus 3. So this guy here has dimensions minus 3. That's this guy here, minus 3. So that times that. So the power spectrum is dimensionless. That's the important point. Oh, the easy way of seeing that, the easy way of seeing that was just that the power spectrum, remember, it was just the log. Remember, the power spectrum was just the contribution of the field variance per log interval of wave numbers. You know, this is dq over q, so that's dimensionless. This guy here is dimensionless because this is just a metric perturbation in real space. So this guy here must be dimensionless. That's another way of seeing it.